This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Some health workers there lost their lives and others are injured. He says we also have some students in Khartoum University who have been stranded there for the past 4 days and they don't have anything to eat.
That's Khartoum resident Hassan Ibrahim, who works as a nurse at Khartoum Teaching Hospital, one of the health facilities forced to shut down. Details coming up. Also, South Africans plan to continue burning coal to generate electricity and has generated anger. And Senegalese singer-songwriter Baba Mal has been named a UN Goodwill Ambassador. These stories and more on African News Tonight. Our top story, the Sudanese capital endured a fourth day of heavy fighting Tuesday despite promises by both the military and rapid support forces to honor a 24-hour ceasefire. Doctors in Sudan say the fighting has forced several hospitals to shut down, as Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
That is the sound of an airstrike that hit close to military headquarters in Khartoum Tuesday morning, as the warring side showed no sign of upholding the ceasefire announced the day before. More fighting raged between the military and the rapid support forces around Khartoum International Airport and the presidential palace. The military remain in control of state television and radio. Meanwhile, the Sudanese Doctors' Union said the death toll has risen to more than 180, with nearly 2,000 others injured. The Sudanese Doctors' Syndicate Steering Committee also reported that 16 hospitals in Khartoum and other cities across the country have been shut down because of damage from the fighting or general insecurity. Several hospitals in Khartoum were evacuated, including Ashab, Ibn Sina, Bashair, Al Turki, Al Zaytuna, Imperial, Ashurta, Bahri and Dr. Salma Center for Kidney Diseases. Others such as Fidel, Al-Baraha and Haja Safi were out of service. Citizens here describe the closure of these health facilities as a humanitarian crime. In speaking to VOA this morning, Haysam Ibrahim, the Secretary General for the Sudanese Red Crescent Society, says their volunteers are having trouble accessing victims of the fighting at the moment. He says the warring parties need to allow some room for humanitarian activities to at least bury the dead bodies before Khartoum becomes an environmentally risky area. He says the health situation is not promising. There are people in the ICU who required immediate oxygen intervention. He says this should be a message to the warring parties to allow passage of medical assistance from the storage areas of the medical supply to the operational hospitals. Another Khartoum resident, Hassan Ibrahim, works as a nurse at Khartoum Teaching Hospital, one of the health facilities forced to shut down. He's speaking to VOA from his residence in Abu Adam neighborhoods. Ibrahim says he escaped downtown Monday morning after heavy shelling and random gunshot made it impossible to continue working in the hospital. He says the main Khartoum Teaching Hospital and the People's Hospital have been hit so much. Some health workers there lost their lives and others are injured. He says we also have some students in Khartoum University who have been stranded there for the past 4 days and they don't have anything to eat. Hapsa Azaki, a mother of five, says there has been no electricity or running water since Saturday. She describes to VOA the situation as unpredictable. There is no bread, she says, and we are only consuming what we had stocked for our Ramadan fasting, such as rice, lentils, macaroni, and other foods. She says nearby shops are open, but we cannot access the main market. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said in a statement Tuesday that aid efforts in Sudan have been interrupted in many areas due to widespread insecurity. It said there are many reports of humanitarian assets being looted. The World Health Organization warned that several of Khartoum's hospitals have run out of blood, transfusion equipment, intravenous fluids, and other vital medical supplies. Michael Atit for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has urged the leaders of Sudan's two warring factions to agree to a ceasefire as the death toll moves above 200. Blinken said today he spoke with them by phone a day after a U.S. diplomatic convoy came under fire in Sudan. He says no one was hurt, but added the incident elevates the urgency of a ceasefire. In addition, the European Union reports its ambassador in Khartoum was attacked in his home.
In the calls that I had this morning with General Samedi and Burhan, I made very clear that any attacks, threats, dangers posed to our diplomats were totally unacceptable. This particular incident is still being investigated in terms of understanding exactly what happened. The initial reports that we have is that it was undertaken by forces associated with the RSF. And again, I made very clear in my conversation with General Hemedi that any attacks that endanger our diplomats are totally unacceptable. And I shared the same with General Burhan.
General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hameti, is the head of the Rapid Support Forces, and General Abdel Fattah Abdelrahman al-Burhan commands Sudan's armed forces. Blinken's call to the two rivals was one of many from the international community urging peace. Volker Perthes, the UN Secretary General, Special Representative to Sudan, says he is in constant contact with both sides.
We are calling, of course, on both sides to stop the fighting immediately, to allow access for aid workers, humanitarian aid workers, and to allow evacuations. We also strongly request both sides to respect the need to protect UN agencies, UN installations, embassies, aid workers, medical facilities.
He indicates that bringing the two sides to negotiate might be difficult. First, he notes, with airports under attack, it is difficult for mediators to reach Khartoum. In addition, he says, neither side seems inclined to negotiate now. Perthes called for all sides to protect aid agencies to allow them to help civilians facing shortages of food, water, and health care.
WFP warehouses, WFP, UNICEF, UNDP, UNHCR, guest houses and offices have come into the crossfire, all being looted and destroyed by men with arms in Darfur in the last 48 hours, which makes it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for humanitarian agencies to deliver aid.
The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Society says it is nearly impossible to provide humanitarian services around Khartoum and warned that the country's health system was at risk of collapse. 26-year-old South Sudanese university student Nayok Mashar says he is stuck in the Sudan capital and has been surviving on water and biscuits since Saturday when fighting broke out in Khartoum.
I'm in one of the areas called South Sherek. It's just some few minutes from where the fighting is really going on. So I'm just indoors. We don't move out. We are shooting on people, and so we decided to just stay indoors. We hear gunshots, we hear cars, these military cars moving, and also a plane, and these heavy artillery, like rockets. So there's a lot of noise. There's too much shooting. I am with friends. Seen on Saturday in the morning when these things happened, so everything was cut off, so we don't have access to the embassy. So I was in the market and this thing started, so I decided to rush home, and so we don't have any connection with the embassy, and we don't even nowhere to reach them. So we are just inside and just surviving on water sometimes. The shops are closed, so shops are closed. So it's only some few shops, like in the evening, that's where we can at least move out and get some biscuit for us, because the shop next to us is small and, you know, is lacking a lot of basic needs.
That's South Sudanese student and VOA listener Nayok Mashar speaking with Nabil Biagio earlier today. One man who spoke to VOA this past hour in Khartoum says the fighting has left many people trapped in their homes in Sudan's capital. As he spoke on the streets, artillery shells flew overhead.
This is a couple of artillery shells being fired right now as I speak with you. The thing is, the downtown Khartoum, the center of Khartoum, it's a really locked up place, and there's a lot of checkpoints and heavy gunfights were going out there. There were a lot of cry outs for people trapped inside. They were trapped for 48 hours without having access to food, water, and some of them, unfortunately, lost their lives, and they have injured people out there. I have heard that the ceasefire itself was planned to evacuate those people from the center. But unfortunately, until this moment, I haven't heard a word that they have been evacuated or not. So probably they are still trapped over there.
That's Walid Adam, resident of the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. He spoke to John Tanza this past hour. It was only 4 years ago that protesters in Khartoum gathered at the gates of the military headquarters to demand the ouster of President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. Their victory brought euphoric hopes for a new Sudan. But the revolution was derailed 18 months ago when Sudan's two most powerful generals joined forces to seize power in a coup. Since then, the country has slumped, its economy tanking, and street protests continuing as the two generals struggled to impose their authority. And now Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hameti, and the head of the paramilitary rapid support forces, and Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the leader of Sudan's army, are fighting between themselves. Why? That's the question I posed to Ahmed Soliman, senior research fellow at Chatham House's Africa program.
I think the main stumbling block, the main kind of growing area of difference between Burhan and between Hameti came around security sector reform issues. These were issues of heightened concern when the military enacted its coup in 2021, and the military, the Sudanese Armed Forces and the RSF together, as you said, have been running the country ever since. And they're a key issue of concern now, just as we were anticipating civilian government was possibly going to emerge from political discussions and following the framework agreement in December of last year. So this issue particularly concerns the integration of the rapid forces into the regular army, the unification and professionalization of that army under civilian authority, and that I think is an area of obviously very critical concern for both the military and Hameti. And
officials have also described Hameti and Burhan's relationship as a loveless marriage where they hate each other's guts. But basically, Sudan is the country that is suffering. Food prices have soared. The electricity cuts are frequent, a plunging currency. When is this going to stop?
It's very difficult to see an end at this current stage when we're seeing this escalating of fighting between not only the most heavily armed and powerful actors in terms of security, but also the most significant actors economically in the country, without a civilian administration in place. As I've mentioned, two actors that have been able to insert themselves within the political process as well and elevate themselves in that way. So as long as they are able to maintain power, and at the moment it looks as if they are fighting between each other to see who will be the successor for Omar al-Bashir, who will be the next strongman dictator of Sudan, not who is going to safeguard the interests of civilians in Sudan and its democratic trajectory, of which they have both claimed. It's very hard to see how the governance situation and the economic situation is going to improve for most Sudanese in the medium term. Of course, in the short term, the issue of security is going to be the key thing in people's minds, and you know, being able to feed themselves, being able to find food, to find water, to have access to electricity. These things are all going to be people's concerns in the short term, as supplies run out, medical supplies run out, and as casualties increase and those who are injured and caught in the crossfire.
Outside intervention, foreign powers actually taking a bold step and intervening. For instance, like Egypt is siding with General Burhan and the army. The United Arab Emirates have allies on both sides. The United States and European countries are leading the push for democracy in part to fend off the Russians. Outside intervention, could it be part of the solution here?
We would hope, you know, I think what you've described quite accurately is how outside intervention can be part of the problem. But we would hope that it could also, given the escalation that we've seen, you know, be part of the solution. And I think it will need to be if there is going to be an immediate, you know, cessation of hostilities in the short term. What we will need now is firm action from the international and regional community, the neighboring countries, to prevent this conflict worsening. So potentially the overspill of this conflict could impact the Horn of Africa, could impact the Sahel, could impact the Gulf, could impact North Africa in ways that we are yet to appreciate, particularly if conflict evolves and becomes more subnational over time.
That was Ahmed Soliman, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House's Africa program. He talked to me from London. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. International environmental groups, investors and donors are outraged at the South African government's announcement that it plans to continue burning coal to generate electricity well into the future. Coal emits harmful gases and scientists say are largely responsible for climate change and South Africa's one of the worst top polluters. While many countries are moving away from fossil fuels, South Africa is moving firmly back towards them. Darren Taylor reports.
South Africa has been in an energy crisis for 16 years, with power outages costing the economy billions, causing immense suffering and loss of jobs. Former President Jacob Zuma promised to upgrade power stations. Instead, a commission of inquiry found he appointed cronies to pillage National Electricity Company, Eskom. The maintenance needed to improve electricity generation was never done. New power stations were racked with corruption, and the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, never built renewable energy projects. The result? Daily blackouts of 4 to 12 hours are now common.
It doesn't look good at all. We did caution that we're going to confront headwinds as we move into the winter period, but what is significant is...
Josiento Ramakgopa is the man recently appointed by President Cyril Ramaphosa to end the energy crisis. Ramaphosa released a plan to generate more electricity, heavily weighted toward renewable energy projects, like the construction of solar and wind farms just a few months ago. International donors, including the United States, gave him $8 billion toward this. But now, Ramakgopa says the only way out of the crisis is to upgrade coal-fired power plants and build new ones at a cost of more billions of dollars. He boldly promised to end the blackouts within 12 to 18 months.
It's absolutely clear that we have to improve the performance of the coal fleet as best we can, and the best way we can.
Independent energy expert Clyde Mellinson advises the government to spend money on maintaining existing coal burning plants, but not to construct new ones. He also says the state must decentralize Eskom and give more autonomy to station managers, and must live up to its promise to put highly experienced engineers in charge of operations.
But in parallel with that, we need to have a massive, massive logistical exercise in putting in new generation, rooftop, on our homes, on our businesses, new wind, new solar, new storage. And that's where the disconnect has been. We haven't been putting in the new at the rate at which the coal fleet is busy dying off.
Mallinson says the government should be relieving the pressure on Eskom by ploughing money into building clean energy plants.
Instead, we're going to them when they're exhausted and saying, we want you to do more. And they're just looking at each other and saying, this guy's crazy. How can we get more out of this coal fleet at the moment? Whereas if you went to them and said, we're expecting you to systematically wind down the coal fleet over the next 10 to 15 years, there would be a sigh of relief, especially if you told them we're bringing in the reinforcements, the new generation, so that you can get that done.
Energy analysts point out that should South Africa continue to burn coal for electricity at the rate that it plans, its economy would suffer immense harm. International markets are introducing taxes aimed at preventing the import of goods from carbon-intensive economies. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Kenya launched its first operational Earth observation satellite to promote space education and science. Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi.
The satellite images that we're seeing over here, it's that right now there's a lot of fragmented land.
Students at St. Scholastica Catholic School in Nairobi explore space technology applications. The learners are members of the school's Space Science Club, an extension of an educational program established by Kenya's Space Agency to promote space education. The students were asked to study their local town.
So the information that the satellite images are telling us between...
13-year-old Ryan Gauna says participating in this club has sparked his interest in engineering.
Electrical engineering, when it comes to setting up the satellites, or maybe even rockets. So that, these are now baby steps, especially from the nanotech that was released in 2018. So from that, I really want to try and do something bigger than what's happening today.
3, 2, 1, ignition.
Kenya's Taifa 1 satellite, which means Nation 1 in Swahili, is the first operational satellite the country has launched this year aboard the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket in the U.S. state of California. In 2018, Kenya stepped into space with the launch of its first nano satellite called CubeSat. Authorities with Kenya's Space Agency say they're reaching out to young students to encourage them to consider a future in the space technology. Charles Mwangi is the agency's acting director, Space Sector and Technology Development.
The conversation that has been happening within the education sector is that many people are not taking science or technology-related subjects, and these are the subject that feeds into the space sector. And we are keen to have them early enough to understand the potential and the opportunities that the sector presents for them.
At least 30 schools have enrolled in the outreach programs, and the agency says it plans to add space technology learning to more school curricula. School teacher Eric Nzioka explains.
With the science and technology, there is investment that has been done in that curriculum for coding. We now have coding in grade 4, 5, 6, and now in grade 7, which is the junior secondary, they have come up with computer studies as an optional subject.
The observation satellite Taifa 1 will be used to provide data on agriculture and food security, among other areas. It was designed and developed by Kenyan engineers like Maureen Wanjiru.
It is exciting in being part of innovative and creative ideas that push, that make an impact in our country. In terms of climate change, in terms of agriculture, forestry.
Entirely funded by the Kenyan government, the Taifa 1 satellite was manufactured and tested in collaboration with a Bulgarian aerospace manufacturer. The launch marks the latest push by African nations to boost space innovation and development. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Audrius Regas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.